We've got a full agenda, so let's get the meeting called to order for State Government Finance. Representative Hewitt, did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair, and so moved.
Representative Hewitt makes the motion to approve the minutes of March 26, 2019. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. And first on our agenda today is Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair members.
Welcome, Chair Hornstein, and you can identify, or when your testifier is ready, she can identify herself for the tape.
Okay.
I see we have an interpreter, so the interpreter.
Yeah. So, well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm very pleased to present to you House File 1968. And this bill comes to us from the Minnesota Commission of Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing. And it is before us to address a very serious problem that we have here in the state. And that is the fact that 56% of state workers leave state employment after a year who have these disabilities. And by contrast, only 9% of state employees without these disabilities leave state employment. So there's a huge gap, a huge disparity that needs to be addressed. And so the question that this bill asks and sets up a process to answer is, why are people with disabilities leaving at such an alarming rate? And this is also reflected in the broader society, where we have 1 in 5 Americans, nearly 56.7 million, living with a disability. And while expressing an ability, desire, and willingness to work in the community and contribute to the economy, many adults and youth with disabilities experience significant barriers to employment. And this is, of course, despite passage of the ADA. And it really is, to me, a core issue of civil rights and human rights. And so we will build a better Minnesota workforce, a better state workforce, if we can address this issue, because individuals with disabilities bring valuable skills to the workforce and represent an untapped segment of the labor pool for both public, private, and nonprofit sector employees. And so we have several testifiers here who can shed some more light on this issue. And again, our bill really looks at addressing this problem with reporting and research, and we believe will help address this issue.
And Chair Hornstein, before we get started with your testifiers, I'll move House File 1968 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Fantastic. So we have
Mr. Chair, just a point of clarification, possible inclusion in the state government finance bill. Would it not also be appropriate for this bill to be heard in HHS? We have not heard it in HHS yet, and I think pursuant to the details of this, I think that at least Chair Moran might appreciate it. There is a fiscal note that shows an expenditure of some sort, I don't have my glasses on it, for human services in the general fund.
We'll let the go for the bill, and we'll talk about that. And we'll
thank you, Mr. Chair.
We may modify the amendment.
Okay,
Representative Hornstein, your testifier.
Thank you. Ann Sittner Anderson is here and will testify.
And for the tape, because we're not on camera, there's a sign language interpreter that's in front of us, so you can proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you, Representative Hornstein, for introducing this very important bill. I'm Ann Sittner Anderson. I have been a state employee for 3.5 years. And I'd like to share some information about myself and my experience as a state employee. I was born deaf and use American Sign Language and spoken English to communicate. I am also a hearing aid user. I was a hard of hearing kid who grew up into a culturally deaf adult. Thanks to the deaf community, I have wonderful friends. I met my husband, and we now have a daughter. Whatever communication barriers I've experienced, I'm always grateful and glad to be a deaf person, and that being deaf is a part of who I am. It inspires me to be an advocate. I have a degree in English writing from Gallaudet University, and I work at the Minnesota Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing as a communications coordinator. I always tell people that I have a very fun job, and it's true. I get to write, which is my passion, and I communicate important messages about legislative activity and communication equity through MNCDHH's website, social media, and videos. I'm lucky to work in a barrier-free environment where all of my coworkers use American Sign Language, or ASL. We all understand accessible equipment needs for people who are deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing, such as video phones and captioning. I receive the accommodations that I need, and I have the equipment that I need to do my job well. Unfortunately, not all state employees with disabilities have the same level of access that I do, or work with a boss who understands communication barriers and equipment needs. Some state employees are not included in meetings because of the cost of accommodations, or are told that they can get information later. This places them at a disadvantage from their colleagues. Even if they do get the information later, it's not the same thing as being engaged in the meeting and contributing in real time. Sometimes state employees with disabilities have to wait months to get a phone, the software, or type of computer that's accessible for them or allows them to do their job effectively. This means they're limited in how successfully or effectively they can work for the time being. This is damaging to employee morale and may harm relationships with coworkers who may not understand the barriers that they face. There is so much discussion about the state's workforce shortage. There is certainly an untapped pool of workers in the state and individuals who have disabilities. I want to see more people with disabilities who have so much to contribute. I want to see them contribute as state employees. I would like the state to have a level playing field and others to have a positive experience in the same way that I have as a state employee with a disability. I urge you to support this study that will help retain state employees with disabilities, define which disabilities qualify for non-competitive appointments, and increase accountability and transparency by strengthening the state's affirmative action statutes. Let's learn how we can recruit and retain the talent needed to address the workforce shortages in the state. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Horstin, you have further testifiers, or?
We're good. Okay. Ms. Hartnett will be here.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mary Hartnett. I'm the Executive Director of the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. Because this is the Finance Committee, I could walk through the policy changes that will be in place, but I went through those during the policy committee. If people have specific questions about the bill, I'm here to respond to questions.
Well, thank you. Okay. Members, any questions? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the author, you'd quoted some statistics on different work areas within the state government. What are the comparable statistics in the private sector? Just trying to understand how the whole environment is sitting. That's with the after 1 year, over 50%, and you've got it broken down 56% for administrators, 55% for professionals, and et cetera.
Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baum, I would defer to Ms. Hartnett.
Ms. Hartnett.
Who has more precise statistics than her.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, members of the committee, that this is from the Affirmative Action Report that is required to be submitted to the legislature every 2 years, but every year, every agency with over 1,000 employees is required to submit an Affirmative Action Report and see where we are as a state in our hiring goals and making sure that we have a diverse workforce and a fair workforce. So I couldn't say what's happening in the private sector, but this is extraordinarily high. When we look at 9% of people without disabilities leaving state employment, 56% leaving, that's a huge problem. It's a waste of human resources, of training people in and then having them leave in a year or 2 years is an extraordinarily huge waste. But we are facing workforce shortages like we've never seen before because people like me are aging out and a lot of workers are going to be leaving. And we need to find the talent we need with such low unemployment rates I believe we're at about 3% right now. It's going to be tough to find the workers we need. And we have the talent we need within one of the talent pools that we have not tapped into is people with disabilities. Once we're able to recruit them and get them to come here, we need to figure out how to keep them and make them productive and workers that have the equipment and tools they need. So I don't know what it is in the private sector, but I'm pretty sure it's not this high. We've never seen numbers like this before.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if the private sector is not this high, it'd be nice to see what they have implemented. I know that in the last few years, technology has made some great strides. And I believe there's technology for, the blind to where you can have somebody speak and it gets translated into a Braille pad. Mm-hmm. And if it is true that the private sector is doing a better job at retention, I think we should, make sure that, this entity looks at best practices, across all the different sectors so we can, come up to date. I think we've gotten rid of our abacuses, but we should see it implementing techniques and technologies that are mainstream elsewhere that could be helpful in this. Thank you.
Representative Quam, I was just using my abacus last night. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hornstein, for bringing this forward. Great idea. Looking at the fiscal note, I see that you're going to bring in somebody to help facilitate conversations and so forth. I'm wondering if you've given a thought, how do you embed it into the culture? In other words, we're going to learn a lot by doing this, but the real fruition of it will be embedding it in the culture so that it actually works.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, I couldn't agree with you more, and I think that's an important part of what we're trying to do here, and I think Ms. Hartnett does have some specific ideas around that.
And Ms. Hartnett.
Mr. Chair and Representative Vogel, that's why we're actually working on a number of pieces of legislation right now, or a number of policy efforts. And one is our office led an effort to negotiate with Governor Dayton Executive Order 1414, because we had an employment study, an employment work group, and we discovered that our employment rate had plummeted with people with disabilities. In 1999, 10% of all state employees had a disability, and we went down to 3.8% in 2014. So we were able, or 2013, so we were able to convince Governor Dayton to sign an executive order that would increase that level to 7% with metrics and developing model systems on how we could train the workforce. And we were able to get the workforce up to 7%. And we were able to get it up to 7%, but people are coming in the door, leaving as fast as they're coming in. So we thought it was really important to, with this study, you'll see that it's disability-led, that it's not led by Minnesota Management and Budget, who oversee their enabling statute oversees all of HR, but that people with disabilities leading the study and asking the questions and bringing their experiences to the table, and they're all state agencies that are charged with bringing the different lens of the different disability groups. So our group is deaf and hard of hearing. We have state services for the blind at the table. We have the Minnesota STAR program. We have who work with the technology that is customized for people with disabilities. So I think by having a disability-led and looking at all those cultural pieces, I think is really important. And some of those recommendations will, of course, be training, training components and considering and making sure that we, when we're looking at having a diverse state, typically we're looking at race, ethnicity, ethnicity and gender, but we should be looking at disability. The intersectionality of the issues are so important to look at. People are, according to the state demographer, people who are African American have far greater rates of disability in this state than the general population. Indigenous people, I believe it's at 29%. So it's really just looking at it. We can't just say, when we're looking at a diverse state, that it's race and gender and ethnicity, it is also disability, and that's what makes us a rich and vibrant culture. And I think having us all embrace each other and not putting each other into silos is really what's important. I think it's an excellent, excellent point.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The last answer really spoke to the issue that I was concerned about, is making sure that we have that inclusive working group that would bring that lens to the table. So I really appreciate the answer that you just gave. But also, too, in speaking with my colleagues, this is about making sure that people feel included in real time. Mm-hmm. I think that testimony is really important for all of us to hear. None of us would want to be told, yes, we're having committee and we'll take your input 3 days from now. Mm-hmm. So that real-time piece is really important. Mm-hmm. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. And Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Hartnett, good morning. I'm just wondering, we've heard you often talk on this issue in health policy as well as health finance, but I'm curious, one, about to your testifier before, who was amazing. I'm just curious, on the first page of the bill, it talks about up to three persons with significant disabilities. Oh. And I'm just wondering if you could expand in terms of the significant disabilities that we speak of often in mm-hmm. health committee. And I'm just wondering, because that is more of a subjective term versus definitionally, what types of disabilities are more prohibitive that we're trying to include in the culture, to Representative Vogel's point?
Ms. Harkin.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, this is an existing statute, and we just there were two on the trial work programs that were put into one section, and it was confusing. And I think we just wanted to separate the two of them out. So it's an existing statute that just was put into a different section, but that would be, it was an on the job. It's a trial work program that was put into place that would have three people with developmental disabilities, was the original concept, sharing one job and working in different environments. Perhaps one idea would be scanning documents, or jobs for people, their tasks that are need to be accomplished, that could be developed for people with disabilities to be working within state government. There's another program that's called the 700-hour program, which is now called Connect 700, which gives people a trial work program in a non-competitive interview. This is in the non-competitive job section of statute. And they're just two separate programs that were in place, that have been in place since the 80s, and we're just separating the two of them out so we can track them. And that's one of the metrics that we're looking at within the report in the affirmative action plan. When the affirmative action plan will be tracking these two to see what works and what doesn't work. We're not monitoring and tracking what works and what doesn't work for these right now. The affirmative action plan will be amended to require that we get the information and the data back so we can continue to improve programs of this kind and get more people in the door.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Hartnett, on page 4, when we talk about the working group on state employment and retention of employees with disabilities, I find no disagreement with the entities listed here, but I find it curious that we are not including employees that are from these communities that have experienced some of the hardships of working. And maybe I'm misinterpreting this a little bit by the up representative in front of it, but I would assume that people that are from these communities, as your testifier was a good example, would certainly want to be participant to this working group.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee and Representative Albright, that certainly is the intent. That is certainly the intent. And by having this working group, it will be making sure that there is a broad representation of people with disabilities that are sitting at the table. That's why we want to have this committee and be in charge to make sure that those voices are at the table and are participating. So we certainly, though you see me and I do not have a hearing loss and I do not have a disability, that the intent will be to make sure that we are engaging those voices. And the way that I envision this happening is doing, you know, follow-up surveys of people that left and people that are still there of what works and what doesn't work, and really making sure that we get those voices at the table.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, just one final question, and this is probably to Representative Hornstein. In the fiscal note, it identifies an outside contractor is going to be responsible for providing this facilitation as a working group. Do you have an entity in mind, or does Ms. Hartnett have a group that they have used in other venues that is appropriate for this consideration?
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, Ms. Hartnett's nodding her head, so I'll defer to her on that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Albright, yes, we'll be using, I'm assuming we'll be using Management Analysis Division. We frequently contract with them. All of our staff go through facilitation training with them, so there'll be co-facilitation with people with disabilities with Management Analysis Division, and they're on a regular basis, they help with report writing, putting those structures in place, and then they help provide a frame for us, and it just makes it easier for us when we contract with them quite frequently.
Thank you, Madam.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Anyone else needs to testify for or against this bill? If not, I'm going to modify my amendment that House File 1968 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee with the recommendation be sent to HHS Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is approved.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.
The next bill we have is 1861, and I understand Representative Bonner is going to be presenting the bill for Representative Pearson. And I'll move House File 1861 for possible inclusion. And members, as we're passing around here right now, an amendment that I understand there's an agreement on. And while that's getting passed off, Representative Bonner, once you can start, and if you're going to hand it off, make sure they identify themselves for the tape before they speak. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, members. Briefly to the amendment, this amendment actually gets this legislation in the proper form and in conjunction with the bill that is moving in the Senate. I have spoken to Representative Pearson, and he is in full support of the measure. With that, members and Madam Chair, I would like to thank you today for allowing me the opportunity to introduce House File 1861 on conflict minerals. I want to thank my co-author, Representative Pearson, for bringing forward this piece of important piece of legislation. For him, this is highly personal. He is the father of two young boys who were adopted from the Democratic Republic of Congo. For me, this bill is equally as personal in that it impacts extreme violence perpetrated against women and young girls whose lives will be forever changed by the atrocities they have endured. In the 90s, the world began to recognize their personal role in the finance and brutal conflicts in parts of Africa, created by the insatiable demand for conflict diamonds, often referred to as blood diamonds. Today, a similar tragedy is unfolding here before us, with minerals that are part of the technology that is pervasive in every aspect of our daily lives. As we connect to the world through cell phones, laptops, and small electronics, we are once again a large part of the problem. Every time a cell phone vibrates, we contribute to the crisis unfolding in a world away in a device that uses conflict minerals like coltan. 90% of the world's coltan is found under the ground in the northeast of Congo. Since 1996, more than 6 million people have been killed in the fight to exert control over these minerals. Government-owned militias, groups, and ordinary citizens have perpetrated terrible acts of violence to force people off the land in their pursuit of greed. These armed groups extract and sell minerals to fuel the purchase of more weapons and to gain control over the area and its people. In 2010, the U.S. passed, and this was nearly over a decade ago almost, that the U.S. passed the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act. One part of this section, which is extremely important, is Section 1502, which requires that publicly traded American electronics companies report mineral purchases from the Congo to the Securities and Exchange Commission. This simple act of transparency is helping to reduce human rights violations in these mining regions. Two states, California and Maryland, have already passed legislation requiring that state purchases of electronics come from these companies are in compliance with the Dodd-Frank reporting requirements. Here at home, both the cities of Edina and the Minnesota State Bar Association have already taken similar action. This bill, House File 1861, would do the same for Minnesota. And with that, Mr. Chair, I do have three testifiers here today with me, Ms. Ellen Kennedy, Dr. Edwija Mubanzi, and Attorney Sarah Erickson. And with that, I would like to turn it over to my testifiers.
And before we do, I'll move that House File 1861 be held over for possible inclusion. And members, the amendment that was passed out did not make the deadline, but if it's okay with the minority, we can take it up. They're shaking their heads, yes. So I'll move the H-1861-A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment's on in place. Proceed with your testimony. Identify yourself to the tape.
Chair Nelson, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to talk about House File 1861. My name is Ellen Kennedy. I'm the founder and the executive director of World Without Genocide, a human rights organization at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law, where I also am an adjunct professor. We educate about violence in many parts of the world, and we advocate for local and national efforts to make a difference. For the past 10 years, I've been speaking all over Minnesota and throughout the country about conflict minerals in Congo and the brutal war that's been fought over these minerals. You've heard now about diamonds used in the 1980s to finance brutal conflict, blood diamonds. And the tragedy today is happening because of the minerals in our small electronics. They're called 3TGs, tin, tungsten, tantalum, also known as coltan, and gold. Every time our phones vibrate, it's because of coltan. And most of the world's coltan comes from Congo. You've heard about the fighting in Congo. Since 1996, more than 6 million people have been killed in Congo in the deadliest conflict since World War II. That number 6 million, when I first learned it, resonated deeply with me because we hear that number in connection with the Holocaust, 6 million Jews who perished then. And yet the 6 million who have perished in Congo are very rarely talked about, are not known, and it's our effort today to raise your awareness. You've heard about, in 2010, the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act, and Section 1502 is the very important part for our purposes this morning. 1502 requires something very simple, that publicly traded U.S. electronics firms like Apple, Intel, and Motorola report every year to the Securities and Exchange Commission where they buy their minerals that go into those electronics. If any of the minerals come from Congo or from a neighboring country, the company must report its due diligence to determine the source of those minerals. Dodd-Frank does not require that those companies divest from Congo, which would be devastating to the economy, or to source their minerals only from what we would call conflict-free mines. The law only requires that companies report where they get the minerals and the due diligence that they practice. And the idea is that being transparent with their supply chain will influence companies to buy from mines that use good practices, because those companies' reports are public. They're on their websites. I'm a member of the Human Rights Commission in the city of Edina, and it was with great pride that we were able to get the city of Edina to adopt a resolution requiring that Edina's city electronics be purchased from companies that are compliant with Dodd-Frank. In 2014, the Minnesota State Bar Association, 17,500 lawyers throughout the state, did the same. California, Maryland, and Massachusetts have all passed similar bills, and one is now pending in Oregon as well. Six cities and 26 colleges and universities have taken this action. Why should Minnesota get involved in what's going on halfway around the world? We already have a precedent in our state, an important precedent that goes back more than a decade. In 2008, the Minnesota legislature and Governor Pawlenty passed a bill to divest our state public pension fund from companies that were complicit with the genocide in the Darfur region of Sudan. Minnesotans did not want their tax dollars supporting a genocide on the other side of the world. In 2016, the bill that we are looking at today about conflict minerals came before the Minnesota legislature. It passed unanimously in both House and Senate committees. It passed on the Senate floor almost unanimously for the same reason. Minnesotans did not want their money spent on products complicit with unspeakable violence. However, in 2016, this same bill never got to the House floor. Perhaps this year will be different, because the crisis is not over. People are still being murdered. Women and girls still face unspeakable violence. Today, I ask you to support transparent purchasing of electronics by our state government. Last year, the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to Dr. Denis Mukwege from Congo. Several years ago, his son, Dr. Alain Mukwege, worked on a fellowship
at our very own Mayo Clinic in Rochester. The global is the local. Our next speaker is a physician, Dr. Edwige Mubanzi, who worked alongside Dr. Mukwege in Congo. She has seen the violence firsthand. Her life has been deeply touched by the victims and the survivors. She will share a very difficult story with us this morning.
And if we can too also make it move along a little bit, we've got other bills on the floor, on the agenda. So welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the tape.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify at today's hearing regarding the conflict mineral bill of my dear country. My name is Edwige Mubanzi. I am a medical doctor from the Democratic Republic of Congo. In my country, I worked in the Panzi Hospital mobile clinic that went to rural areas to find and treat women victims of rape and mutilation. I worked alongside my mentor, Dr. Denis Mukwege, a co-recipient of the 2018 Nobel Peace Prize. Rape is used as a weapon of war in Congo. The war is about controlling our mineral resources, especially coltan, which is used for cell phones and computers all over the world. 80% of the world's supply of coltan comes from the eastern part of the Congo, where I am from. Since 1998, more than 400,000 women and girls have been raped in this war. Today, my country is called the rape capital of the world. Rape is an effective war strategy, and it's destroying my community. Usually, women are raped in front of their husbands and children. This destroys the whole family and enables militias to control population and therefore the mineral resources. After raping a woman, militia members often insert blunt, dangerous objects into her vagina to destroy her body. This practice not only destroys a woman's body, often causing leakage of body fluid from the vagina and the inability to have children. It completely destroys her spirit. At Panzi Hospital, I performed hundreds of operations to repair this wound of rape. I would like to share the story of one of my patients. During a night shift at Panzi Hospital, I received a woman that I knew because I had treated her before. She was a victim of rape and became pregnant from that rape. This time she came with her 6-month-old baby, and I was afraid that she was raped again. But she told me that she had not come for herself. She had come for her baby. Her baby, born of rape, was raped at 6 months old. This has become an intergenerational problem in my country. The physical findings were very heartbreaking. This was the reason I decided, besides treating my patients, I also had to advocate for them. And this is why I'm here today. We all know how the exploitation and illegal trade of natural resources is linked to financing of armed groups and massive human rights violation. I and we cannot solely repair the consequences of violence. We must treat the root cause of this violence to put an end to these horrific crimes. Minerals from Congo need to be mined in a lawful manner that respects the life of all people. This is why I'm here, engaged in a plea for peace, justice, and respect for human rights. It's urgent to act. the solution exists and require real political will. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the vote in support of this bill will be a victory for human rights and stability in my country, the Democratic Republic of Congo. With humility and hope, I now ask this committee to support this legislation to help transform blood minerals into minerals for development and peace. This is an opportunity to solve the real problem of Congo, and we need your support. Thank you again for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you for being here.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Erickson. I am the Policy and Programs Manager at World Without Genocide. Dr. Kennedy mentioned that improvements have been made in Congo since implementing Dodd-Frank. I'm just going to share a few of those. Congolese officials, the UN and the US, and many organizations have developed a conflict-free certification and audit process. This is modeled on the Kimberley process certification scheme that was used in the trading of blood diamonds 15 years ago. In 2010, before Dodd-Frank, no mines were certified as conflict-free. Today, 495 mines are conflict-free. Publicly held companies like Apple and Motorola buy their minerals from these mines. If those minerals originate in Congo or adjoining countries, companies must report that to the Securities and Exchange Commission and state which mines, smelters, and refineries they buy them from. The reports are made public. The mines undergo audits by reliable organizations to determine if they are conflict-free. The audits are conducted in accordance with standards that apply to other SEC requirements and with standards established by the Comptroller General of the U.S. A conflict-free mine receives certification to that effect. Minerals sold from mines without this certification are appraised at much lower values because companies don't want to buy from uncertified mines. Armed militia groups responsible for the violence in eastern Congo make less from minerals from uncertified mines and find it difficult to sell minerals from uncertified mines at all. In March 2018, the Trump administration adopted new standards for federal purchasing of electronics, such as computers and monitors. These standards include a conflict minerals provision, including due diligence, whether the company is helping to build the conflict-free trade in Congo and the region, and whether the company is sourcing from audited conflict-free suppliers. This strengthens the Dodd-Frank legislation, and the Federal Environmental Protection Agency has adopted these criteria for federal purchasers to the U.S. as well as others around the globe, such as the EU, who are now required to procure products that meet this standard. As of the most recent study by the International Peace Information Service in 2016, 79% of 3TG miners did not work under the control of armed actors any longer. This bill increases Minnesota's dedication to transparency in government spending. This is good fiscal policy, and it's also good ethics. I want to just close by sharing some words from a Congolese community leader working in the mining areas. He said, "As a native of Congo, I have seen firsthand what things are like on the ground. Gang rape, modern child slavery, and violations on a massive scale. Some people may not understand how a U.S. law related to corporate supply chain sourcing practices could stop this horrific decades-long conflict. However, the Dodd-Frank Act has done much to reduce violence in my country. It is one of the main reasons why armed groups no longer wield the power they once enjoyed. We can make a difference in Congo from Minnesota. I urge your support for this bill. Thank you."
Thank you. Any further testifiers? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank the testifiers for helping us to remember that there is inhuman evil in this world. And, you know, since World War II, we've had multiple examples where millions have been killed, you know, whether it's the, you know, Mao Stalin, the killing fields in Cambodia, we also have the issues of where girls in Africa are taken. What I'm trying to understand is you know, you'd referenced the Trump administration had expanded activity beyond the Dodd, or, you know, from the previous legislation. I'm trying to understand what this bill actually helps do. On the face, first impression was we're basically saying we want to make sure that people are actually following the federal law. Now, if you know, Trump went farther and there's an improvement, can the state also, and with this legislation, take those additional steps and improvements? Because, you know, apparently that only affects federal procurement. So, you know, I'd like to understand how that went farther and how this bill could be more strongly effective in reaching the end results.
Ms. Erickson?
Sure. Chair, Representative Quam, the way that this was, the further steps were implemented at the federal level was through the EPA's certification process for companies that sell electronics, and this is known as EPEAT. And what the EPEAT process does is reassesses its standards for certification of those companies every so often through the IEEE standards. And so this round of that added a provision that in effect just complied with the Dodd-Frank Amendment, saying that any electronics like computers, monitors, cell phones purchased for federal use will be held to that standard of purchasing from conflict-free companies. So it didn't necessarily expand it any broader, but it reinforced it in a different way, is how I would say.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as the amended version, does it also require the EPEAT you know, functions, or do we have to more fully illuminate and specify in a future amendment?
Ms. Erickson?
Chair, may I? Okay. All of the companies that the state of Minnesota would be purchasing these from have to comply with the EP requirements under the federal laws, so they would all, if they would be in violation of the Minnesota bill, they'd also be in violation of the federal law, so it shouldn't be an issue.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Bonner, thank you for bringing this forward. I just have a couple questions, and it only pertains to just to kind of the parameters around one detail in the amendment, and I'm certainly happy to have you answer it or someone from the department with regard to it. But in subdivision 3, talks about the exemption for contracts of a value of less than $100,000. So I'm just wondering, in broad brush strokes, if you could answer the question in terms of how many contracts exceed or fall under this threshold.
I think we'll allow the representative from the State Procurement Office to answer that question.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you. My name is Betsy Hayes. I'm the Chief Procurement Officer with the Department of Administration. Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, all of the contracts that we have with respect to our IT hardware would exceed that 100,000 parameter. The exception that's noted in that in the amendment really was intended for unique circumstances where perhaps there's an individual out in the field that needs to do a purchase order or use a purchasing card to address a small urgent need, but everything on contract would be covered in excess of $100,000 on all of our IT contracts.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Ms. Hayes, then that probably answers the following question in terms of on line 1.9 of the amendment where it says DIRP, the commissioner determines that compliance is not practicable. Would that be appropriate in the context of a field acquisition?
Ms. Hayes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, yes, that's exactly what that flexibility is intended for, are those unique circumstances where the individual would be out and unable to obtain the certification required.
Mr. Chair, one final question.
Albright.
Thank you. Ms. Hayes, or to Representative Bonner, on the original document bill on line 1.16, it talks about or its neighboring countries. And so I'm just wondering if that's where a border is shared. I heard from testimony from one of the testifiers about adjoining. So I'm just looking for a little clarity in terms of what countries would also be included in this, the context of the bill.
Ms. Kennedy.
Chair Nelson and Representative. One of the most frequently involved countries is the neighboring country of Rwanda, so that country often is highlighted.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Again, Representative Bonner, thank you for bringing this forward. I do recall, I think, that Representative Kahn was an initial chief author of this bill, and it was certainly warranted then, and it's certainly warranted now, so thank you for your compelling testimony and for being supportive of this. Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and obviously powerful testimony. Thank you for bringing that forward. In the realm of why we're here, state government finance, and I was reading the fiscal notes, and maybe if, you know, the department, you could comment. It says, because this bill relates to vendor requirements that are already mandated under federal law, the Office of State Procurement does not anticipate any change in the eligibility of the vendors. So would you speak to, I mean, I understand there's an issue we're trying to get at a problem, but I don't see this actually changing. We're already complying. I mean, could you speak to just how this will change what we do or how we do it? Because it doesn't even have a fiscal impact because it, you anticipate doing things as you've done them.
Ms. Hayes.
Mr. Chair and Representative, in a sense, it I think provides awareness for the vendor community. They're having to make an affirmative attestation at the time they submit a response to our bids. So I think while they're affirming that they're in compliance with what is already a federal requirement, I think it brings that level of awareness and transparency that we haven't seen before.
Ms. Olson, Representative Olson.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question has to do with that $100,000 in the amendment. Am I right in saying that the state normally is not going to actually buy the mineral in any quantity? So all you're really talking about is the cell phones that have the particular mineral in them.
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Hayes.
Representative, I'm not aware of any purchase of the raw mineral itself that we would be talking about the use of the minerals in the electronic devices.
Okay. So going on that assumption,
Representative Mason.
I'm thinking it would take an awful lot of cell phones to come up to $100,000. The cell phones are small, so I can't imagine that the mineral being used in these is any huge quantity. So will this, other than a moral support, does that really, $100,000 to me, makes things much more difficult to accomplish?
Ms. Hayes, I think you said already that most of your purchase of computer equipment is over $100,000, but...
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, the measure of that dollar amount is based on the contract. So an individual purchase of a cell phone surely would be under $100,000. However, it's purchased against a state contract that exceeds the $100,000. So you would include that these provisions on that individual purchase, because that purchase is tied to a contract that would always exceed $100,000.
Representative Mason.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, testifiers, for bringing this forward, and certainly it's a step in the right direction. But it's my understanding that Rwanda and Uganda are the occupying forces invading eastern part of the DRC, and that these occupations and their bad behavior upon the people of the Congo is being perpetrated by them. Besides this backdoor effort to restrict supply, can you comment if those forces have been removed from the Congo, what efforts have been done internationally to oust these foreign invaders that are plundering your resources and to restore order to your society, which is really the root of the problem?
Dr. Kennedy?
Chair, Representative, you ask a very complicated question. And there have been many efforts to try to provide diplomatic and other forms of influence in the country to try to quell the violence. There, one of the most effective tools has been this economic approach. I think it's important to acknowledge, as Dr. Mubanzi did as well, that many of the militias are homegrown militias in that country. These are people who, in many cases, are desperately poor, and the opportunity to extract wealth for themselves, for their own communities, at the great human cost of others, is really at the forefront of the violence. The foreign influence, of course, destabilized the whole region, certainly in the late 90s. But it's my understanding that in the more recent past, most of that violence has been indeed from militia groups within the country.
Representative Hertas. And we're getting a little far afield for what state government finance deals with.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that reply. And it's just disappointing and dismaying to find out that the international community isn't doing anything through the United Nations to stop this. Apparently, the minerals are so important that this condition is allowed to persist.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Normally, I look at a bill for what does it do for the solution. And frankly, the state of Minnesota probably has not a great deal of effect. But the public testimony, the shining the light, the publicity, the communication, I think is the main effect that this legislation does. I wish that we had a solution. And most feel-good bills I have trouble with because they delay working to a solution. But right now, the only option we have of impacting is the communication, is the public hearing, the testimony when it goes through committees, and with having it as a reminder to suppliers that the state does believe that this is an issue. So I wish that we could have snap our fingers and do something more substantive, but don't belittle or overlook the fact that just by having this hearing, we are having impact.
With that, members, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1861 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. Thank you for your. And Representative Detmer. And members, currently we don't have possession of this bill. We were supposed to have it, and there's an amendment that came late that it's not in your packet. And my members, we're going to hear this bill for informational purposes right now, and if we get the bill before tomorrow's hearing, we can take it up right away in the beginning of the hearing and deal with it. Otherwise, Friday or later this week. So, Representative Detmer, with that in mind, you can keep your testimony short, and because we have another bill after this that I think is important to the chair. And
Mr. Chair, and I'll be back tomorrow morning to make the official.
Hopefully, we have. Yeah, if we don't, and we'll notify you if we don't get the the amendments.
But again, thank you for the hearing here today. And as most of you recall, in 2016, the legislature passed legislation to fund the Medal of Honor Memorial that's going to be located right in front of the Veterans Building on the Capitol grounds. And this is something that, you know, Minnesota's had 72 Medal of Honor recipients, and that dates back to the Civil War. But with that, I would like to just turn it over to the Vice Chair of the Medal of Honor Committee, and that's Tiffany Kowaleski.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the tape and proceed.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. I am Tiffany Kowaleski. I am the co-chair for the Minnesota Medal of Honor Memorial. So we're here today because fundraising for a brick and mortar in a monument is extremely difficult, especially one like the Minnesota Medal of Honor Memorial, because it is truly altruistic. There is no names of any organization, no matter if you donate $500,000 or $5. Between the Super Bowl, the Final Four, the governor's race, you name it, funds are tied up with financial corporations, and we're really having to rely heavily on private donations, and believe it or not, charitable gambling donations is where we're getting a majority of our private funding from. We were fortunate to have an appropriation of $250,000 from the state, and we were able to match that. Currently, we've raised $532,000, and it really does show something to our financial corporations and our private donors to have the state's involvement in this, to show that this is something that you back as well. So as of right now, we are kind of coming up to some brick walls, and we've had a board meeting last night, and we are leaving no stone unturned. We're now going into the rotaries, you name it. And if anyone has any fundraising advice, we're all ears, more than happy. So this $150,000 appropriation that we are asking for is the last and final push. We will not come back. You will never see me testifying here asking you for any more money for this memorial. Keep in mind that this memorial is at the footsteps of the Capitol grounds, and that we are reconstructing something that has been broken for over two decades with the promise of youth sculpture. So with that, we're able to make this a multi-generational memorial, tying our young children as young as they can comprehend, walking down the Capitol grounds themselves or being pushed in a stroller, all the way to attending with our World War II veterans of our family members ourselves. So with that, and knowing that your timeline, I'll open the question or open the floor up for any questions. Chair.
And Mr. Manzelli?
And also we have Mr. Paul Mandel here. He's with the Capitol Area Architectural and Planning Board. And I'd ask him to make some comments.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Mandel, Executive Secretary for the Capitol Area Architectural and Planning Board. And I'll just leave it for questions and anything you have.
And I have on my list John Kramer. Is he?
Mr. Kramer is right up there.
Does he need to testify, or is he just there for? Why don't you come on down then?
And Mr. Kramer is the chair of the committee, Medal of Honor Committee.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. and committee members. My name is John Kramer, and I'm chairman of the Minnesota Medal of Honor Memorial, and just had wanted to share a few words with the perspective that we share with past generations and are bringing to the present generation with this memorial. Cass Gilbert, who was not only the Capitol building architect, but also the landscape architect for the memorial, had wanted, along with military veteran legislators of the era, a memorial honoring all veterans of Minnesota, spanning the history of our state. And that's what we're bringing together with this Medal of Honor Memorial. It's a memorial not only to our Medal of Honor recipients, but to all veterans spanning the history of our state. And that is the additional clarification I had wanted to make on the significance of our memorial.
Well, thank you. Members, questions? If not, Representative Detmer, thank you for the testimony. And if we, I'll be in contact with you. If we get it in our possession or referred to us, we will have you back tomorrow morning, and we'll get this passed off quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you.
Chair Nelson
and members, I will move House File 1962 to be for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And Ms. and members, this bill is about creating a working group and dealing with some of the issues that we've had in the state about accessibility of our documents that we put out there. It's an important issue. We hear, at the times we hear there, Mr. Heller comes down here and talks about documents that we have and accessibility of that from people with different disabilities and other issues that causing some people with disabilities to be able to access the Capitol and access us here. And the page, we've got a...
It's just right. Here we are.
And with that, I will turn the testimony over to Ms. Hartnett, who brought the bill to me, and we'll go from there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you, Chair Nelson, for bringing forward this very important bill. We have a letter that was written that you're about to get distributed that doesn't have the letterhead from the Senate, but it was written by Senator Westrum. And Senator Westrum has been working on this issue and asked me to find a willing legislator on the House side because he is the chief author on the Senate side. And Representative Nelson was more than willing to step forward because this is an issue that is important to everyone. The commission in 2009 was able to get accessibility standards passed for the state. Before that, people who with disabilities weren't able to access websites. They weren't able to fill out their own timesheets online because we didn't have accessible software. So we were able to get legislation passed that set accessibility standards and put together a technology accessibility advisory committee that would put in place an exception process so there wouldn't be an undue burden to the state. So making sure that we have standards that set a floor for everybody, and then anything else would have to be an accommodation or a specialized response to somebody with a disability. So we've had that in place for a long time. We were able to get funding for the Chief Information Accessibility Officer, who's here today, Jay Wyant, we were able to get funding for the legislature to have closed captions on their television. So some of the legislature has been made accessible, but it's time now for the state to adopt these standards. And I think that Senator Westrom has articulated the issue very well and makes his case. Perhaps you'd like to read it.
Well, and members, you got the letter in front of you, and I just know when Representative Westrom served in the House, he always had difficulty in committees, and as Representative Quam pointed out earlier, he had a reader, that Braille reader that he used when stuff was passed out, and he's worked on it. But he's had a tough time being a legislator because some of the stuff is not there. Some of the aides aren't there to help them. I also have the earlier bill, I didn't mention it, but I have a sister-in-law that is deaf, has been deaf since she lost her hearing when she had measles in her youth, and so it's an issue that is important to me and my family also, because that's an issue that I've had to deal with in my own family. And members, if you look, there's a fiscal note for this, and if you read through the fiscal note, there's a small piece for the work group, which normally is absorbed by the LCC. The biggest piece of this is bringing the states, all the states' websites and documents and everything up to the standards that we are holding other people to, and so that's what the fiscal note entails. So members, if you open up for questions, and
thank you, Mr. Chair, Mrs. Hartnett. Any questions for Chair Nelson or Ms. Hartnett? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. I've often wondered about this committee room, because you can listen to it. We have closed caption, but do the closed caption functions generate a texted format that would be available for someone that was, you know, was hearing impaired? And then also, do we ever translate or convert it into a something that can be run into, you know, a Braille tablet?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Greg Hubinger can answer that question from the LCC.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. The House and Senate each audio stream all of their committee hearings. Only if there is a request from the public does that get captured and converted into a text document. That would be required under the Human Rights Act, where any document or video or audio production of a public body has to be made available in an accessible format upon request.
Representative Quam.
Thank you. Since we already have the functionality to do the closed caption, and frankly, it doesn't need video to, you know, feed in the information to the system that does the closed caption, we already have the capability of creating a text version or transcript of any meeting. And so in the committee rooms that do not have capability for it to be televised, why aren't we already making that accessible?
Is it Mr. Hubinger?
Hubinger. Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, the captioning that gets produced now is done by taking the audio stream for either the audio or the video, and then a person repeats that, what they hear, and it's captured in a voice-to-text computer program, and that generates the caption. So it's a human-based process. We do that for two signals all day long, and that's made, and that's available to the public. But we don't do that for all of the other committee hearings where audio is provided.
Representative Quam, did you have a follow-up? And I see that.
I do a quick follow-up, because there's already the technology. I mean, a decade ago, I worked, volunteered with the IBM's project to be able to do we had people with different dialects feeding in to be able to do that, where you could speak in it. I mean, on my phone, I get voice messages, but they have a text version It's out there, and I'm just surprised that the legislature hasn't looked at utilizing that function.
Mr. Hubinger, did you want to comment? And I see that Ms. Hartnett also wanted to make a comment as well.
Well, yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, we tested some audio to text programs a couple of years ago, and this is not a unfortunately a clean setting where we have one speaker speaking at a time. There are people speaking over each other. The audio isn't always great. The failure rate was around 90%. The House is conducting some pilot programs on some recent software. They did that last interim. That seemed much more promising, and we'll be looking at that as part of the working group that's proposed here.
Ms. Hartnett, did you have a follow-up?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Kwan, the technology accessibility, Chief Information Accessibility Officer is part of this group, and he's set the standards for the state and is really very conversant with the latest technologies and accessibility technologies, and we'll be working closely with the working group to get them caught up with what's possible and what's feasible, what's reasonable.
Okay. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, thank you for taking on a very tough subject. In looking at the fiscal note, I do note some disclaimers, if you will, in terms of the difficulties that have to be overcome in order to really fully implement this, namely just the fluid nature of the legislative day, notwithstanding changes that occur to bills or whatnot. I'm just wondering, as you move forward in the with the working group, is there an attempt to maybe kind of scope this out in terms of achievable parts first and look at the longer term, or are we looking at this in the whole rather than achievable first steps? That would be my first question.
Chair Nelson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Albright. I would think we'd be the practical way would be to do what's achievable and move from there. I know from some of the discussions I've had with Mr. Heller, when we have bills posted as XXX bills, he cannot access those online because there's not a number that they can be pulled from. Sometimes when documents are provided by, like you said, the fluid nature of documents are provided by outside people, they're not on the website right away. And sometimes just Secretary of State the other day gave us one that had a gray shaded box. Well, that gray shaded box made it impossible for it to be read by his reader. And so these are things that we're going to have to, that I think the working group's going to have to look at and bring forward recommendations, and then we're going to have to start working, picking these off. I don't think it's a thing that we're going to snap our fingers and everything's going to be accessible. We're going to have to do this piece by piece, figure out what works, if there's technology that can help us, as Representative Crom pointed out, that does work. We can. Those are the things we're looking to do to get the state moved in that direction, so that all of our citizens can have access to the information that we put out as a state.
Ms. Hartnett, I see you wanted to make a comment. Representative Albright, do you have a follow-up?
Mm-hmm. No, I'll let Ms. Hartnett finish.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, right now the state has standards, and the state employees know where they stop and where they start and what's expected of them. And more needs to happen, and we have legislation that is requiring more rollout and more implementation of the what's called 16E.03 subdivision 9, which are our state accessibility standards. The legislative staff are asked to respond to every request without any box around it. I mean, it's unlimited what the expectations are. And some of the expectations aren't reasonable. I mean, I think that they're an accommodation that could be made for an individual, but we don't have a floor yet that is set. And the state, the legislative workers, and we work with them closely, are amazing. I mean, I think the staff on the Senate and the House and the LCC, all bodies are working very, very hard. But I think this will help provide a roadmap of what is expected, and those parameters will be set and be clear, and I think it'll be much. We'll provide them the direction that they need, and the public will know what that expectations have been set and what they can expect.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Chair Nelson. I'm just wondering, and this is not to invoke fear or anything, but you know, obviously, with the ADA and the responsibilities to be compliant with the ADA, and to later with the Olmstead Act, I'm sure this is also relevant to that. it's not only just a responsibility and obligation that we have to the citizens of the state of Minnesota, which we recognize, but I would presume that there's probably also a little bit of liability issue here for not being in compliance, and not that we need to address that right now, but just as a statement that we share the concern, you and I, that, you know, we should make every effort to make sure that our citizens are afforded the opportunity to engage with their legislature. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not sure which testifier might be too, but and to some extent relative to the question that Representative Albright just asked, I'm curious if there, you know, I had worked with some legislation on ADA relative to the private sector and those what I consider to be frivolous lawsuits, mm-hmm. where attorneys were just milking businesses on ADA things. I'm wondering how, and maybe you can't answer it, but how do we compare to where we should be relative maybe to the private sector? In other words, the private sector is affected by ADA just like we are, and I'm just curious, are we behind the curve and catching up here? Are we doing our job? And I know that's a tough question, may not have an answer, but I just wonder, for a relative sense of knowing that this is something we need to do, how much do we need to do, maybe just to catch up to where we should be relative to the private sector, if indeed that's a problem? And then going forward, obviously, we have to stay there, too.
Chair Nelson.
Ms. Hart will answer that question.
Okay. Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in 2008, I believe, or 2007, before we got the technology standards passed, Target had a lawsuit lodged against it because it wasn't the sites weren't accessible, and I believe it was a $10 million or $12 million lawsuit that was won, and it pushed their business into getting more accessible and following there wasn't clear guidance at the time with the idea of what those standards should be, but then that's was the impetus or one of the arguments that we made for the adoption of accessibility standards. And so since that time, with very few resources, the state, with Jay Wyant's very able guidance, has been able to provide training modules for the rest of the state. And quite frankly, they're very underfunded. But there is we are in a much better place than we were. Every state agency has a state accessibility, IT accessibility coordinator. We have legislation, the last bill that we had, that will require all of the agencies to report how they've implemented this bill. So it's layered, but I would say that we are in much better shape than we were before, and we haven't had any, to my knowledge, lawsuits that have been filed as a result. That's an indication. So we can always get better, but we are much better than we were before. Jay, would you agree?
Okay. And Mr. Chair, we do live in a litigious society, and yeah. There's all sorts of jokes about mm-hmm. too many lawyers, but we won't go there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as the conversation evolves, I just suggest that we keep in mind and do some comparison mm-hmm. things there, just to make sure that we're keeping up with those that we regulate. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Any other member questions? Anybody from the audience would like to testify for or against this bill? Okay.
This is Mary.
Yep.
Ms. Hartnett? This is Mary Hartnett, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I would be remiss if I didn't say that this was also very supported by the State Council on Disability and on the Disability Agency Forum, which is all of the disability agency groups that advocate on behalf of people with disabilities. So the commission is, you know, approached Representative Nelson, and all of actually the leadership have signed on both the House and the Senate on these bills, but that it's a cross-disability effort.
Mr. Chair, Chair Nelson, before we move House File 1962 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, do you want to make any final statements?
No, thank you, members, for the good discussion, and I'll renew my motion that House File 1962 be laid over for possible inclusion.
With that, as a reminder to members, thank you, Jim. So we're meeting on Friday, 10 a.m. That time will remain fluid, so keep an eye on your calendars. The time is set. The agenda is what will remain fluid. So there we go. Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, and I think that we mentioned this in committee maybe yesterday, but Chair Nelson, I think you and I have an understanding that the vice chair is responsible for breakfast that day.
Tony, I told you I'd buy you breakfast.
I just want to be clear in the understanding from the both minority and majority that the vice chair is responsible for sustenance.
All right. I'll bring you treats on Friday.
Representative Albright, as I said yesterday, that the speaker has said that we're not supposed to do harassing of other members.
This is not harassment. No, this is blatant coercion.
And I know she pointed out it's a freshman, but anyway.
Anything to win over the favor of my Republican colleagues, I will bring in treats on Friday. Consider it done.
It's nutritional wolf.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Another reminder. The meeting on Friday will be in the Capitol, room 120. Great. With that, we're adjourned.